Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers. First, in conversation with Katie Hafner, is Dr. Lou Ann Brizendine. Lou Ann Brizendine, MD, is a practicing neuropsychiatrist, a New York Times best-selling author, and media commentator specializing in sex differences and the male and female brain. Her first book, The Female Brain, has been translated into 30 languages, and its follow-up, a pamphlet called The Male Brain, is now in 15 languages. She's currently working on her new book, The Parenting Brain. Katie Hafner, our author, was on staff at the New York Times for 10 years, where she remains a frequent contributor, writing on healthcare and technology. She's also worked at Newsweek and Business Week, and has written the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Wired, The New Republic, The Huffington Post, and the Oprah Magazine. She's also author of 5 previous works of nonfiction covering a diverse range of topics, including the origins of the Internet, computer hackers, German reunification, and the pianist Glenn Gould. Mother, Daughter, Me is Katie's 6th book. In Harper's Magazine, Jane Smiley said, "Mother, Daughter, Me delivers an unusually graceful story that balances honesty and tact. Hafner narrates the events so adeptly that they feel enlightening rather than enervating." The book was just chosen as Oprah's Book of the Week. So to open our program, I'll turn the podium over to Lou Ann and let you take it. Thank you.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I just wanted to say before we get started tonight that I find this book riveting, and I've read it a couple of times now, and I just want to compliment you on just what a terrifically gifted writer you are.
Oh, wow. Thanks.
And if you haven't read it, it actually is a page-turner. Most memoirs, I haven't really read memoirs in the past that have been quite the page-turner that this one is, so I recommend all of you to experience that. And I would like to ask you to start off with if you would be willing to read a passage to give us a feeling for the beautiful language that you have in this book.
I'd love to. Let me put a little context around it. So the book is about a misbegotten experiment in 2009 that my mother and I embarked on in multi-generational living. And she hadn't raised me, actually. I was taken away from her when I was 10 and didn't actually know her. And not only that, I didn't know just how angry it turned out I was, unbeknownst to me, about my childhood, just how much bitterness there was. So this is a scene shortly after she has moved in. We're in the kitchen, and we're unpacking boxes. My mother and I choose to distract ourselves with what surrounds us in the here and now, several dozen boxes filled with kitchenware. I usually enjoy setting up a new kitchen, but this has become a joyless and highly charged task. My mother and I each have our own set of kitchen boxes, which means that if there are 2 cheese graters between us, only one will make it into a cupboard. The other will be put back in a box or given to Goodwill. Each such little decision has the weight of a Middle East negotiation. At first, it was fine. As we put away bowls and plates, salad servers and toast tongs, my mother turned to me and said, undiluted joy in her voice, "We're commingling." I shuddered, perhaps even panicked, which is why I've now turned churlish. While her kitchenware is serviceable, I'm a sucker for the high end, all clad saucepans and Emile Henri pie dishes. Before long, I'm shaking my head at pretty much everything my mother removes from her San Diego boxes. She takes each rejected item as a personal slight, which, in fact, it is. I begrudge her even her lightweight bowls, which she can lift easily with her injured hand. I'm determined to stake my claim as the expert at equipping and running a kitchen, which is, after all, the focal point of domestic life. But there's something else at work, too. Here she is, a fragile old woman, barely able to bend down as she peers into a low cupboard, looking for a place where she can share life with her grown daughter. At such a sight, my heart should be big, but it's small. So small that when I see her start stuffing her serving spoons into the same drawer as my own sturdy pieces, lovingly accumulated over the years, it makes me crazy. Suddenly, I'm acting out decades of unvoiced anger about my mother's parenting, which seems to be materializing in the form of her makeshift collection of kitchenware being unpacked into my drawers. When I became a mother myself, I developed a self-righteous sense of superiority to my mother. I was better than my mother for having successfully picked myself up and dusted myself off, for never having lain in bed for days on end too blotto to get my child off to school or even to know if it was a school day. By sheer force of will and strength of character, I believed I had risen above all that she succumbed to and skirted all that I might have inherited. This, of course, is too obnoxiously smug to say in words. So I say it with flatware.
So you see what I mean. She just has a lovely way with her writing. I heard that you're just back from a trip down to L.A. to actually sit in the recording studio and do what I remember when I recorded my book, endlessly read every line over and over again to record it until you got it perfect.
Yeah.
How was that?
Well, okay, so here's what happened. So I wrote this book, and it's very, very, very emotional, the whole book. And Random House, which has the audiobook rights, so the audiobook rights got sold, and it's called Tantor Audio, and they're based in Connecticut, and they sent some samples of people who wanted to read it. And the people who and the samples, they were real people, but they sounded like robots. I just thought to myself, this is just, you know, I wrote this, I know better than anyone what it. You know, so I said, could I please read my own book? And they said, no, you'd have to come to Connecticut. I said, I can't come to Connecticut. And so we figured it out. And so I went to this little studio in Van Nuys down in L.A. And, you know, I'm driving around. I go to this. It's like these places are in the most unlikely places. It was in this sort of very residential area. And the little recording studio was behind this guy's house, and went into this sort of airless, cramped little booth, and I was in there for 3 full days, about 7 hours a day, reading this thing, which was an out-of-body experience, because there are light moments, but there's a lot of darkness too, and there are 3 sudden deaths in the book, and so I'm reading this and it's all kind of happening in real time, and they're not, you know, just any deaths, but my husband and my father and my sister, and it was grueling. And you feel kind of possessed, and at the same time, you know, I would do it, and it was so hard, and yet I would do it again in a minute.
To be in your own voice, yeah.
And to be so, you know, there's something about reading your own words that makes you accountable in a way that you're not really when you're writing. I don't know if you've had that experience, but that's, so it was fascinating.
As I told Katie, it made me wish I'd put more commas in my, right.
You can have some of my commas.
I have some of your commas.
I use a lot of commas.
You know, that brings me to another question that I had, because I know your other writing, and I kind of know you as a journalist, and I noticed that you said something in You say in one part of the book that at an early age you learned to observe but not to engage. And I think that's towards the end of the book where you say that. But I read that and I was wondering about that as I was thinking about questions I'd like to have you reflect on. But I know that you're a trained professional journalist, and that the observer in you, of course, would resonate well with that. But then to switch to memoir, I was wondering, you know, about the engage part, since in reading this book, I don't feel at all like you're just obviously observing, but you're self-observing. And how did you get yourself to almost take yourself as the subject?
It wasn't easy. So I am a journalist, and I write narrative nonfiction. When I write books, they're all narrative nonfiction, and then my journalism is very much at a distance. I mean, I don't write anything. I have not, until this, written anything personal. I think I did write a piece once for the Times when I was working for the circuit section about buying a rug online in the early days of online shopping. That felt like I felt exposed. And don't ask me why I did this, but so the first drafts were quite hideous. I mean, they were really very, as one reader who actually is in this room, his reaction was, it's like it's this book about this person named Katie Hafner, written by this journalist named Katie Hafner, and there was like this big disconnect between the emotions and the events. And so what I had to do in subsequent drafts was really dig deep in a way that I didn't feel comfortable with, but did it. And you know, with a book like this, you have to be analytical about pretty much everything, or else the reader is going to feel shortchanged. It's like, why am I reading this story? What's in it for me, in a way? And so until I knew what was in it for me, the reader wouldn't know what was in it for them. Mm-hmm. And so, and they needed to know that I understood what I was writing. And it was hard. I'm not good at that. And yet,
you eventually, are now.
Yeah, got there and did that. So, memoir writing, you think, because when I got the contract with Random House, I thought, oh, great, a memoir, no research, you know. This will go really fast, and it's like the hardest thing I've ever done, easily.
You know, I also wanted to ask you a question about, you know, the experience of, I know you wrote both about your mother and your daughter, but I was thinking about if you could tell us a little bit about what it was like to write about your daughter and how she is with it and how she has reacted to it, and also how it was to write about her.
So my daughter was 16. So when we started this little experiment, my mother was 77, almost 78. My daughter was 15, almost 16. I was 51. And which is in itself, you know, with a 16-year-old girl, it was kind of a recipe for disaster. But she had lost her father. My husband had died very suddenly when she was 8. And so she was already very much tied to me. And so when I got the contract to write the book, I went to both of them. I went to my mother and my daughter. And I said to my daughter, I said, I'm writing this book. She goes, yeah, yeah, mom, whatever. And that was the end of that. And my mother said, she said two things. She said, write whatever you want, and I won't read it, which was interesting. And with that kind of permission, I felt it was liberating. It was very, very, very nice of her. And Zoe has, she's my daughter Zoe, she's just been great. She didn't want to read it for the longest time, and then she did, and she's a huge sort of champion of the whole thing. And she's the portrait of Zoe is very honest. You know, that's the thing about this book, is it has to be an honest portrait, because if it's not, again, the reader is gonna have your number. And there's this thing known in both fiction, usually in fiction, as an unreliable narrator, and they're gonna figure it out pretty quickly. And so, as the narrator, the reader needs to feel like they're in good hands, and that you are, that it's a full disclosure kind of thing that's, that they're reading. And so you can't really pull any punches or hold things back. And with Zoe, I couldn't, so I couldn't really gild that particular lily because, she was a teenager and she was going through the full complement of teenage psychodramas. And it was, she was great about it.
That's great. You know, I noticed that you say, you also quote Judith Wallerstein's book, and you chose the quote, "The love and compassion daughters of divorce feel for their mothers who are alone." And in reading that line that you use from Judy's work, I was wondering, was this book a kind of letter of forgiveness and understanding to your mother?
I think so, yes. I mean, I don't know who here is familiar with Judy Wallerstein's work. She died a couple of years ago. She was an amazing kind of pioneer in this area of divorce. She wrote a really famous book called The Legacy of Divorce. And the amazing thing about her, I'll just go off on a slight tangent, is that in the book, what happens is, so my husband died very, very suddenly of a heart attack when he was off on a business trip at age 45. Zoe was 8. I was 45. And I didn't know how to tell her. Zoe was out of the house. And I didn't know how to tell her the news. And so the university, he worked at Cal, and the university put me in touch. We lived in Berkeley, put me in touch with Judy Wallerstein, and I kind of knew the name, and she immediately called me, and she walked me through exactly what to say to Zoe, and it really stuck with me. And then years and years later, I was writing the book, I was trying to figure this whole thing out about, which I had really never thought about, what is it like to be the child of divorce? My mother was also an alcoholic, but that's a whole other thing, you know, that's another book that I had to read. So I picked up this book, which is The Legacy of Divorce, and it was this longitudinal study of kids whose parents had divorced when they were young. And what you're quoting is this, how it is that the child feels like they have to be the caregiver to their mother, because in those days, in the 60s and 70s, the child was with the mother. Usually just the mother, and it's a wrenching thing to see your mother alone and struggling. And then on top of it, my sister and my sister was 2 years older than me. We had the alcoholism to deal with, and being her caregiver for that, which my sister took most of the burden of that, and shielded me from a lot of it. And so I had never, not only had I not forgiven, I hadn't even gotten to the place where I hadn't forgiven yet. So in the book, I go through not forgiving and then forgiving. And it's an incredible process that I wasn't even that aware that I was doing until the book was finished. And it was through the book that it happened. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, because I was thinking that, you know, when I read that, I kind of had a different idea about, it's at the very, probably in the last maybe 20, 25 pages of the book where you go to that, the compassion and love that, you know, young children sometimes have for their mother if the mother's alone. So
yeah,
somehow I felt like the I know that maybe you could say something. It's very hard to write a book like this about forgiveness. You know, the phrase forgive and forget comes to mind, but I almost feel like you've kind of written about, it's almost your book is like forgive and remember.
Forgive and, oh boy, yeah, Luann, that's great. Yeah, forgive and remember. I hadn't thought of that before, and I think that's right. In fact, one of the epigraphs, and I'll find it as a, has to do with that very concept. I'll flip through it while we're talking. But this whole idea of seeing your parent struggling alone was absolutely huge for me, which I didn't, as I say, I didn't even grapple with until this whole experiment in living together came about. And then there's a really poignant part at the end of the book where I say to her, I read the Wallerstein book, right? And then I call her and I say, there's a book I want you to read. And this is a woman, we had actually gone to therapy to try to work out what was going on. Because there was, as soon as she moved in there, I had a cruel streak in me surface that I didn't even know I possessed. It was incredibly painful. And then I was asking her to revisit all this stuff from my childhood before I was taken away from her, about her alcoholism that she had absolutely no desire to revisit. And
our memory of perhaps sometimes alcoholics don't remember
some of the book talks about these the sort of that phase of life being a big cognitive blackout, and so she didn't remember a lot of it. So there I am asking her to recall something she doesn't remember, which also angered me, and then the fact that she didn't remember it, but then I had to understand why. And then and she said to me at one point, and we had, by the way, we had never, ever spoken about it. We had never talked about what happened. So what happened was, when I was 10, she had a horrible episode. We were living in San Diego, and my sister found her, and she was really unconscious, and my grandfather flew out from Boston, and basically my sister and I, we were airlifted out of San Diego and taken to live with my father and stepmother, who I'd never met, and her three kids who I'd never met. It was sort of another crazy thing, but my mother and I had never discussed this, and so, I mean, never until I was 51 years old. And there had been one incident where Zoe was about 4. And you know how when your kid is little and they've got all these art projects that they're, and they just sort of generate these things, they come out of nowhere, all these art, and it's like, what am I going to do with all this? And so you're going through it all, and you're trying to decide what might they want to have, you know, when they're older. And I was doing that with all Zoe's big pieces of art. And I thought, what happened to my stuff? So I called my mother and I said, what happened to my stuff? And she got so quiet and pretty defensive. And I thought, okay, we won't go there. And that was the closest we ever came to talking about it. And it wasn't until we went into that therapist's office and we started talking about it. And it was just too much for her. And there was one point where she just said, you know what? I prefer to live the unexamined life. And I thought, you know, that's her prerogative. That's
interesting.
What she's chosen.
You know, that you're when you're in psychiatry training school, like I was at one point, some of you that may be in the business or of therapy may remember what we used to call and still are trained in what's called the three generational model of understanding a person's life, and kind of what they're facing three generations down. So that would be looking at you and then your mother and then her mother.
Right.
And
ooh.
I know you speak a little in here about your grandmother. And for full disclosure, my husband, who's in the audience, actually knew your grandfather. And your grandfather was a revered scientist, as you know.
A physicist, yeah.
Physicist, yes. And so my husband was a scribe at some of their meetings in Boston. So
that's amazing.
That goes back away. So that's of course, I'm not sure he ever met your grandmother, but certainly your grandfather he met, and he was a revered person. And but your grandfather and your grandmother, who, could you say a little bit more about them? I know you talk about them in the book, but taking it back to who your mother grew up with, what kinds of people she grew up with, what were they like?
Well, so I assume that when you talk about this three generational model, you're doing it with the person of the third generation to understand the generations that precede the person,
and also to help that person not pass on the trauma that may have been passed down for three generations.
Right, and that's a huge part of the book, is this breaking of generational cycle. So my grandparents were very prominent scientists on the East Coast, first at Columbia, then MIT. And my grandfather was a physicist. He invented the atomic clock, And he was a science advisor to Eisenhower and all of that, you know, impressive stuff. And then my grandmother was a biologist at Harvard and then MIT. And they were really accomplished but really horrible parents. They didn't have one nurturing bone in between them. And so my mother got none of that.
So she was alone even as a child.
She was alone, yeah, as a child. And there were 11 years between her and her sister. And then, so my mother, and I believe truly and deeply that my mother was different, that that my mother loved my sister and me and didn't, and she, but she was 19. She dropped out of college where she was studying physics, and she told me once she started studying physics just so that her father would, like, have something to talk to her about, or would talk to her, which is very sad. And actually that didn't work. And
but unusual for a woman in those days to be in science for either your grandmother or your mother.
You right, know? Exactly.
It's a very lonely world for women now, but even then it was worse.
Exactly. And then my mother married my father, who was also a physicist. And and so my mother just had not had that. I don't know if you go through it. There's this whole idea of modeling parenting, and she hadn't had a model. And so she was 19. Think about it. You know, you're 19. My child is now 19, and if she became a parent, I would be absolutely appalled and frightened to death. And so there she is.
Isn't
she's got
she
these
with
two.
Her boyfriend now?
Yeah. She, gosh. So there she is with these two little kids. She's got the, and then the, think about this. Then they're in the early, late 50s, early 60s when there was the cocktail hour. And so she was living for 5 o'clock every day. And that was kind of her savior when 5 o'clock came. And then it didn't end for her, you know. Then she'd go into these, you know, binges that would last for a long time. Finally, she just picked us up. We were living in Rochester, New York, and moved us to Florida. My sister and me left my father, moved us to Florida. And this was Luann was not able to break the cycle. Mm-hmm. And then someone asked me recently, weren't you scared to become a parent yourself? And I looked at them and I said, no, never. It never occurred to me that I would perpetuate the cycle. And I don't know why. But, I was by no means a perfect parent. I made huge mistakes in raising Zoe, but I managed in the main to break that cycle. And I don't know what it was in me that did it. And we won't turn this into a whole, Dr. Brizendine thing.
But I think it's helpful for people, for the audience to kind of to understand the multi-generational piece of this, that it sounds like your mother, you know, kind of got caught up by being a teenage mother, basically, she was. And then, you know, her pain and suffering may have been, she's being numbed by alcohol as a, you know, one of the solutions to emotional pain, of course, we all know, is all kinds of substances to try and deaden the pain. So it sounds like that's the part you didn't pick up the... you didn't pick up a heroin habit along the way, did you, Katie? Or anything. So can I ask you if you think, now that you kind of have a little distance from it, the book has been published, you've done the reading of it, do you feel that it was, and in what way, if it was it therapeutic for you to write this? Because I know I've had many patients that write diaries or they write journals, or sometimes they're usually private, of course, not out in public. So, but if you divorce the experience of having this all be public, was it therapeutic for you in the whole?
Oh, absolutely, it was therapeutic. And I have to say, and apologies in advance because of your profession, but I've been to therapists through the years. Nothing ever worked. I mean, maybe I got a series of duds and didn't go to you or Sam or whoever.
Well, the evidence-based data on whether psychotherapy works or not never turns out too well for those of you.
Well, these therapists, they say to me, well, how do you feel? And I'm like, I don't know. Aren't you supposed to know? And but then in writing the book, when I was really, really forced, as I said earlier, to sit down, you know, confront this stuff and really try to understand what, for instance, like, so my editor, there were a few people reading the book as I was writing. One was Bob Wachter, who's in the audience, who's now my husband. And
he appears in the book as Bob.
As Bob. He is Bob. Not, his name is not changed. And then my very best friend, Candace, who's actually here. And these are busy people, right? And they would sit down with me and really say, well, what on earth were you thinking? I mean, in fact, and my editor, who was more therapist than editor, instead of in the comments in a Word document, instead of like, oh, I don't think this really flows, this scene doesn't really belong in this chapter, which is what most editors do, she'd say things like, what on earth were you thinking when you said this to your mother? Or why didn't you defend, you know, your mother against Zoe? And so that was fantastic. That was really, really wonderful. And someone said to me once, gee, you're getting paid to, like, understand all this. And it was really nice. And then it was, in fact, you know, one of the things that people talk about is how much we carry, how much anger we carry, how much bitterness we carry, how much sorrow we carry through our lives. And so I was having dinner with a friend who's in Amherst. I was actually in Amherst, Massachusetts, which is where much of the book takes place. Not much of it, but a lot of my childhood. My sister and I ended up in Amherst. And so I was in Amherst recently doing a reading, and I had dinner the next night with a friend of mine who's a Buddhist, and I'm not a Buddhist, but I listen very carefully to everything he says because I revere Buddhists, and I think everything they say must be very, very wise. But he's a Buddhist and a lawyer, so go figure. But anyway, so he told me this story. We were talking about carrying stuff through your life, and he told me this story. He said, okay, there's this famous story. There are two monks, and they are on a journey, on a hike. One is the student, and one is the teacher. And they have, of course, been taught never, ever to touch a woman. And they come to a stream with a very strong current. And at the edge of the stream is a beautiful woman, and she can't cross. And so the teacher, he picks her up, he carries her across the stream, and he puts her down. And they keep walking, and they're walking, and hours into this, as they continue their hike, finally the student, he can't contain himself any longer, and he says, teacher, I'm just so messed up in the head, because we were taught never to touch a woman. And the teacher says, ah, what I did was pick up that woman, carry her across the stream, and put her down. You have been carrying her all day. And I thought, bingo, you know, that is what I did. I picked up my pen, so to speak, and wrote this out and put it down, and I'm done. And it's, you know, I mean, if there is such a thing as being at peace, I think that I'm as close as I'll get.
That's great. I was wondering if in your travels and around the bookstores, I know you did a reading at Warwick's and
in La Jolla,
and
all the old stomping grounds
and in Amherst and et cetera, in your readings, what has been the audience's reaction so far, kind of in the public, in the bookstores?
Good. I mean, well, it's kind of self-selecting. I mean, people come because they're interested, a lot of people have read the book and like it a lot. But it's been, sometimes it's amazing. Some of the questions things people say, just that, like this one woman, at Book Passage in the Ferry Building about a month ago, this woman just raised her hand. She said, I want to thank you for writing this. And I thought, oh, you're welcome. She said, just that you would sit down and tell this story. What a lot of people have said, you know, they'll stand up and they'll say that this was not my experience. Either I had a great relationship with my mother, or we had no alcoholism in our family, or there was no divorce, or I had a very, very happy childhood. And yet, they say that it resonates with them on some level, and that's really gratifying that you feel. And this is what I said before: is if unless you're, you know, to just sit there and, you know, write out your story is one thing, but to write out a story that people can relate to is that's another. So
it's very gratifying. Right?
Very incredibly gratifying.
I know that you say in the book, and I just want to, because I find you very courageous to basically be, you know, exposing just how it was from your perspective. But you say in the book that, quote, anything to avoid reliving the turmoil I experienced as a child was why you always wanted to flee instead of stay and deal with conflict. And as I read that from you, I was quite impressed at, if that is your natural tendency in your life, to flee rather than to stay and to deal with it. This is a really a turning, it seems to be turning some kind of a new leaf for you, because this is really the ultimate in staying and dealing with the conflict.
You know, it is and it isn't. You know, you're really just writing it. I mean, this, and that's a distance. That, by the way, is why the audiobook was so hard to read, mm-hmm. because it's much closer to the bone when you're saying every single word
out loud.
You know, a lot of writers say that they always read their own writing aloud, just and I'm either too lazy or forget, and I often don't, although it's a very, very good idea to do it. And when I was reading every word out loud, that was it. That felt much more like I was not, I couldn't flee. I mean, I'm sitting in this little recording booth. There was nowhere I could go. The door was locked. Man.
You had to wallow in it.
I had to wallow in it. That's exactly what I was doing. But yet, you know, the whole fleeing thing, that's a totally classic, almost cliche thing about children of, alcoholics is kind of a get me out of here.
The conflict avoidance, yeah.
I don't know, you know this.
Yes, yeah, right. Okay. This is not exactly avoiding. You were wallowing it the last 3 or 4 days. So I would be remiss if I didn't kind of also say, I kind of got onto your Amazon site and I read a whole lot of the reviews, and I know that a lot of people are basically feeling that, you know, they were wondering how your mother is taking all this, and just that it's a very tough thing to do and to talk about things that she actually didn't remember a lot of what happened. How is she doing with that, or is that?
I think she's struggling. I think you know, it's one thing to look in a mirror voluntarily, which is what I did with the book, and it's another thing entirely to thrust a mirror in someone's face and ask them to look. And so it's...
So she didn't keep her promise to not read it. She did read it.
I believe she has read it, or okay. Good parts, a large part of it, yeah.
Okay. That's what I'm thinking about. Certainly the experience of being having a child who's an adolescent, which is my experience of having a child that's like angry at me for all kinds of things. And as a parent, that's very painful.
It is painful because another thing the real central question of this book is, what is our obligation to our parents as they age? And then in my case, particularly if they gave us a less than perfect childhood. And I come down very hard on the side of, and I got this from Candace, who took care of her mother unerringly at the end of her mother's life, and that's actually in the book, is that our parents do the best they can given what they had to work with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely true. And in my mother's case, you know, when alcohol enters the picture, when it entered the picture for my sister and me, we just didn't stand a chance. She didn't stand a chance. It's unbelievably toxic and powerful and hard.
All right. And I think that the parents who are divorced and children who are divorced, which are half of them in California, are in situations.
Half? Really?
Of marriages end in divorce. So That's still pretty high, and that means there's a lot of kids out there living this back and forth life. So I think you've done a book that a lot of people will read and be able to resonate with parts of it in the process of their own healing. So I just want to give her a hand for a wonderful book. And we were hoping to be able to also take some questions from the audience. And I know that there is a microphone available that we will turn on. And your questions will be recorded so that the audience will be able to also hear your questions and Katie's answers.
This is an unusual memoir in that you wrote it in real time and you were recording events in real time. How did you prevent the fact that you were observing in real time from changing the nature of the events?
Well, actually, I don't know. I mean, that's the ultimate problem, isn't it? So I don't know if it changed the nature of the events, although I was somewhat discreet. I wasn't discreet in the... So the point is, I'm assuming... The point that you're making is that I had to take notes. I had to get things down right. And dialogue, there's a lot of dialogue that I couldn't make up. I had to get down. I have a terrible memory, and so I can't even remember what anyone has said 2 seconds ago. So I really had to write it down. And when we were in the therapist's office, I had my computer on my lap. So I told my mother and the therapist that I was writing the book, and this was like 3 months. I didn't go into this experiment in multi-generational living expecting to write a book. That was an accident. We can talk about that later if you want. So I realized I had to take notes. One day I show up in the therapist's office with the computer, and I'm like taking notes, and it was, but at one point the therapist said, "Why do I feel like there are four of us in this room?" And then I worked in this house we were all living in. I worked at the kitchen table, and I worked at my computer. And so I'd be working along, just typing or whatever I was doing, and working on my stuff. And all this drama would suddenly start swirling around me between my mother and my daughter or something, and I just typed that up too. So that had to be recorded. But yeah, it is. It's this. Somebody said that I had invented a new kind of writing, they call it reality prose, which I thought was interesting. This woman from the New York Times interviewed me, and she said, "Why didn't you wait, until you'd put some distance between you and the events?" And I said, "You know what? I couldn't wait. It was the kind of thing that I had to write it as it was happening in order to try to understand it. Otherwise, it would have kind of like softened and mellowed, and so that felt important."
Katie, I have a question.
John.
Given the history with your childhood and your mom and everything, what led you to this experiment of having her come? please tell us.
What were you thinking?
Well, this is where the phrase magical thinking is absolutely appropriate. I mean, I just had this fairy tale idea, this gauzy notion that my mother and I would be sort of skipping through the daisies, that we could have this life together, this family that we had never had. And, I like to think I'm an optimist. Friends who were quite skeptical, they sort of voiced their skepticism and then backed off when I said, no, I think this will work out just fine. And, it was a disaster. She moved out after, we were calling it when we went into it, our year in Provence, and it very quickly turned into first purgatory and then just full-blown hell. And she moved out after 6 months, but she very, very generously at one point, we were looking for a place for her to live, and she found this wonderful apartment in Pacific Heights, and we were driving, home after she had decided to take it, and she said, you know what, Katie, it was a noble experiment. And I thought that was incredibly good of her.
I have another what were you thinking question.
There are a lot of those.
Tell me about your thoughts around exposing your 15-year-old daughter to somebody on a daily basis that had alcoholic tendencies.
Boy, is that ever a good question, and you're the very first to ask that. First of all, our children are exposed all the time to the, you know, especially in high school, to alcohol. It becomes a big issue starting in high school. The other interesting thing about my mother is that she had not been she stopped drinking. This is interesting in terms of your multi-generational, your three-generation question. She stopped drinking in 1989, the day she heard her mother was dying. And so she stopped drinking heavily. She didn't, however, stop entirely. And she has something called partial abstinence, where she can drink just a tiny bit and it doesn't trigger the need to keep drink to go off on a bender. So Zoe was not exposed to that, but what I had told Zoe as a little girl was that we had alcoholism on both sides of the family in a big way, and for Zoe it's like walking between dodging raindrops because there's so much of it. And so in a way, the fact that my mother was there and had had a history of drinking was immaterial. I would never have brought someone with an active drinking problem into our house, ever. And that, I can promise you.
Well, thank you very much. We want to thank our author, Katie Hafner, for her presentation tonight, and Dr. Lou Anne Brizendine for being in conversation. Will you stay after, and if when people buy their books, would you sign them, Katie?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so they are outside. That's wonderful. All right. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.